This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, August 26, 2009. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, fact-checking John Keats. Normally on this program, we listen to contemporary American poetry, but today we're crossing the Atlantic and going back nearly two centuries to John Keats. Keats, of course, was the romantic English poet who died young at age 25 after writing some of the most celebrated poems in the language. We're going to listen to just one of them, the sonnet called On First Looking into Chapman's Homer, which has a long history of controversy behind it. I'm joined on the phone by Charles Zepka, a professor of English at Boston University. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how are you, Curtis?
Good. So we're going to get to the controversy over this poem in a moment, but first I was hoping you would set the scene for us. When and why did John Keats write this very peculiar sonnet, which I guess essentially is a rave review of George Chapman's Elizabethan translation of Homer's Odyssey? It's a very strange subject for a poem.
Well, it is, and it also has some rather strange imagery and governing metaphors, drawing on the Spanish conquest of America, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote it in September of 1816. He had just returned to London from Kent. Previous to that, he had taken his medical examination to become an apothecary. He was a very good student of medicine, but he just lost interest in it and became a very enthusiastic student of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And he returned to London about a month after an old school friend of his had settled there, named Charles Cowden Clarke. The two of them decided to get together, and the occasion was that Clarke had come into possession of a huge folio volume of a translation of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey by the Renaissance poet George Chapman.
Mm-hmm.
So Keats went over to Clark's house one evening, their first meeting since their school days, and read through what Clark called some of the famousest passages that they knew from reading Pope's translation.
Right.
And Keats was so overwhelmed by his first experience with Chapman's Homer that when he went back home that night, he stayed up late into the early hours, and wrote the sonnet on first looking into Chapman's Homer, and sent it to Clarke at dawn, and there it was at breakfast. That was the beginning of Keats' decision not to pursue medicine, and his decision to commit himself entirely to becoming a poet rather than a doctor.
So let's hear the poem. Here's Michael Stuhlbarg reading On First Looking into Chapman's Homer by John Keats.
Much have I traveled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told, that deep-browed Homer ruled as his domain. Yet did I never breathe its pure serene, till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies, when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez, when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien.
That was Michael Stuhlbarg reading On First Looking into Chapman's Homer. So, Chuck, I guess it's fair to say that Keats really, really, really liked Chapman's Homer.
Oh, he did, and he wasn't alone. I mean, this was a period in which Renaissance poets like Chapman were being rescued and dusted off and just celebrated again.
Mm-hmm. Now, many commentators have pointed out what appears to be a factual error in the poem, and it's in these final six lines.
Then felt I like some watcher of the skies, when a new planet swims into his ken.
Nothing wrong there, but here it comes.
Or like stout Cortez, when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien.
The supposed error is that Cortez, the conquistador of Mexico, was never in Darien, which is in Panama. So Keats may have confused Cortez with Vasco Núñez de Balboa, who crossed the Isthmus of Panama and was the first European to see the Pacific Ocean from the New World.
Mm-hmm.
I know you don't think that's an error. We're going to get to that in a second. But who first pointed this out as an error?
Well, this wasn't pointed out till 1861. The poem was first published in December of 1816. So we've got like a half a century there.
And no fact-checking. Nobody said, this can't be right. Right.
Okay. I mean, and he had very knowledgeable friends.
Yeah.
Not a word for decades and decades until Tennyson puts this little footnote saying, history here requires Balboa, A.T., for Alfred Tennyson. And from then on, everyone just piles on. It's amazing how many people take this as gospel based on this little footnote of Tennyson.
And you think Tennyson was maybe a little jealous of Keats's talent?
Well, he admired Keats a tremendous amount. You can see the influence there quite clearly.
Right.
But he also tended to bristle when people would point this out.
Uh-huh.
And if there's one thing Tennyson prided himself on particularly, it was historical savvy and his care with historical fact.
Uh-huh.
And I just wonder if, this is pure speculation on my part, but I just wonder if it's this one point where Tennyson said, aha, maybe Keats was a better poet, but I'm a better historian.
But I got my facts straight.
I got my facts straight.
But he does have a case, because Cortes never was in Panama, to the best of everybody's knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So what's wrong with this, assuming that he did make a mistake, and so what?
Well, for one thing, if you look at any of the sources available to Keats at the time, it's very ambiguous, the question of whether or not Cortes stood on a peak in Darien himself.
So based on his sources, Keats probably got his facts right.
Yeah. The other thing is that from a formal point of view, the poem demands that we read Cortes rather than Balboa, because the poem is a poem about belatedness. It's about coming late to the discovery of Homer. It's about the mediation of an original experience by someone else. In the original poem, by the way, the line,
"Yet did I never breathe its pure serene,"
was originally, "Yet never did I know what men could mean." So I've heard of this experience, but it wasn't until I read Chapman, or if you will, stood in the place of Chapman, that I understood what that first original discovery could mean. So the poem is all about belatedness, and it wouldn't make sense from that point of view to say, "Then I felt like Balboa," like someone who could read Greek, for instance, like Chapman himself.
Right.
The figure of Cortes is there as a figure, a sort of a focal point for this sense of belatedness, of having heard but now understanding what that original experience, that immediate experience would be.
Now, if your reading is correct, Keats is assuming an awful lot of historical knowledge from his readers.
Well, remember, his original reader is Charles Cowden Clark.
Uh-huh.
So we have to ask ourselves, what was his level of historical knowledge? It was extremely good, at least as good, if not better, than Keats's himself.
Now, what do you make of the lines that say, "Cortes, with eagle eyes, he stared at the Pacific,
and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise"?
Cortes seems to know what he's looking at, and his men are baffled. How does that play into this idea of seeing Homer for the first time?
Well, I think one thing we have to ask ourselves is, what are the men wildly surmising about? Are they asking themselves, what the hell is this thing we're looking at? What's this body of water here?
That's the way I read it.
Well, another way of reading it, they're surmising and asking themselves, what's with Cortes? Why is he standing there and staring? In other words, what kind of experience is he having that we don't understand? The disjunction being underlined here is the disjunction between a figure capable of being moved by the sublime. Most people are oblivious to that experience. I think his men are, you can imagine, they're tired. Why are we stopping here and staring? So I think that's another way of making sense of that wild surmise line.
Yeah, that would make sense. If Keats is seeing himself, putting himself in Cortes's shoe as a reader of Chapman's Homer,
right,
the rest of us are going to wonder, why is he so mesmerized by this this one book of poetry? And we're going to be the men who look at him with wild surmise, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, another way of reading that is Keats saying, "I was once there. I was once one of those men.
Mm.
Now I understand, and you, reader, will understand if you pay attention to how I'm describing this feeling."
Mm-hmm.
Look at the metaphors he introduces to convey to us that sense of wonder and sublimity and awe.
"Much have I traveled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold."
If you think of Keats wandering those western isles, they're all held in fealty to Apollo, who's, if we look at analogies here, he's the king of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So all poets hold their little domains, their little territories or islands of expertise as delegates of, or viceroys of, Apollo, the emperor of all poets.
Oft of one wide expanse had I been told that deep-browed Homer ruled as his domain.
But there's one major player here. There's one, you know, major viceroy who holds the entire Pacific Ocean, as it were, and that's Homer. So I think Keats is saying, I'm looking for some place to conquer and call my own, much in the way in which Cortez was looking for territories to conquer.
Let's hear the poem one more time with your reading in mind.
Much have I traveled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told that deep-browed Homer ruled as his domain, yet did I never breathe its pure serene till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien.
One of the things that struck me most forcibly about the whole Cortez-Balboa controversy is how quick people are to assume that Keats was an ignorant buffoon. He didn't know anything about history when he probably knew more about the Spanish-American conquest than any other poet of his generation or any other famous poet.
So why did the reading that Keats made a big error become conventional after Tennyson? Did everyone just enjoy what one critic called the best known boner in English poetry? did they just like that Keats blew it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's one editor, I think, who said Keats's error, I don't know if I get this exactly right, gives us the luxury of forgiving John Keats. Uh-huh. I think really nails this sense of, I mean, again, I think this is what motivates Tennyson. Hmm. We, like Tennyson, we feel awed, grateful, and utterly crushed and subservient to a talent this enormous.
And so young, too.
And so young.
Well, deep down, I think most of us hate genius, right?
yeah, I think so.
Charles Zepka is a professor of English at Boston University. His essay on Keats's sonnet will be available in a collection of his essays coming out from Ashgate Press. You can read the poem and lots more Keats on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where you can also read articles, watch poetry videos, download the Poetry Magazine podcast, and otherwise wallow in poetry to your heart's content. We always like to hear from listeners. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.